Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 28th of March, these are our main stories. The Filipino president promises countermeasures over what he describes as China's dangerous attacks in the South China Sea. Fighting between Israel and Hamas has been raging around at least three hospitals in Gaza. Colombia expels Argentine diplomats after President Javier Milei calls his Colombian counterpart a murderer. Also in this podcast,
we really need to be doing more for people affected by motor neuron disease. And, you know, the earlier we intervene, the more likely we are to be successful with therapies.
A new test that could detect early signs of the disease. China and the Philippines have long been at loggerheads over the South China Sea. But after recent confrontations in which Filipino troops have been injured and vessels damaged, the president of the Philippines has said his country will not be cowed into silence. In what seems to be a further escalation of their dispute, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. pledged to take countermeasures against Beijing. China, which claims almost the entire sea as its own, responded by suggesting the Philippines is to blame for the tensions. Beijing's foreign ministry spokesman, Lin Jian, accused Manila of hypocrisy.
Who's been stirring up trouble and causing provocation on the South China Sea issue? Who's been breaching the common understanding between our two countries and reneged on their own commitments? Who's been staging a show and hyping up tensions? Who's been pulling forces from outside the region to interfere in the issue?
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us what was known about the Filipino president's threat to China.
Ferdinand Marcos Jr. didn't actually say in his statement about these package of countermeasures he was going to impose, but certainly it raises the possibility of further tension and joining, importantly, joining the United States, because the US is a treaty ally of the Philippines and promised to help it. And in fact, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. said he'd been in consultation with his allies and they'd offered to help. It's essentially this dispute centres around the second Thomas Shoal, where the Philippines has run aground a vessel and has stationed a number of troops over recent months, as it has done for the last two decades. It's been trying to resupply the troops there, and China has been trying to stop these resupply vessels by either getting in front of the Philippine ships or firing water cannon at them and recently laying out a barrier to stop them getting near the boat. So this is what Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is responding to. And as I said, the potential now is that all those people who have been watching this have been wondering who's going to blink first, who's going to threaten increased action, and it's Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
Mickey Bristow. Well, China's relations with the Philippines may have worsened, but Beijing appears keener than ever to improve its previously fractious relationship with Australia. China has just announced it will remove tariffs on Australian wine. The tariffs were imposed 4 years ago following Canberra's call for an investigation into the origins of COVID-19. So why the change of heart? Here's our China correspondent, Laura Bicker.
China imposed tariffs of up to 200% on Australian wine in 2020 after the then Australian Prime Minister called for an objective, independent assessment of how the COVID-19 pandemic began. It cost suppliers an estimated $1.2 billion and left them with the equivalent of 859 Olympic swimming pools of wine in storage. Today's announcement follows a series of meetings between the two nations after a change in the Australian government. In November, the new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, became the first Australian Premier to visit Beijing since 2016. He said then that it was in the interests of both countries to stabilise the relationship.
Laura Bicker. There has been heavy fighting around several hospitals in Gaza, even as medical staff warn conditions are already catastrophic for patients and displaced people who've sought refuge. Israel says Hamas fighters are using the sites as their bases. Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, has been under siege for 11 days, with Israeli forces reporting that they've killed or captured hundreds of Palestinian militants. Dina Abu Shaban lives near the hospital. Her family was forced to evacuate before it was bombed.
When the tank suddenly came in, there was heavy firing, so we got scared and opened the windows and saw the Israeli army within our area and the maternity unit of the hospital. There is constant bombardment from all areas. We're tired because we hear people screaming and we hear the speakers at night broadcasting to people to evacuate.
This all comes as even Israel's closest allies have expressed concern over the vast loss of life, the widespread destruction and the worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where people are now starving to death. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell, is following developments. She told us more about the latest fighting.
It's particularly concentrated the Israeli military operations in Gaza City around the Shifa Hospital, where you've had a raid going on there for 11 days now. And also in the very south of the Gaza Strip in Khan Yunus, where you have two big hospitals that are affected there. So this is all having a major knock-on effect on healthcare. If you look at the Shifa Hospital, first of all, you've got the Israeli military saying that it has managed to kill dozens of Hamas and Islamic Jihad fighters since it moved back in there. But according to officials in the Hamas-run health ministry, you have doctors and patients who are caught up in all of this. They're now confined in a sort of administrative building inside the hospital. They're asking for international help to get them out. The Israeli military says that it is providing those medical teams with support, with food, with water, and has given them a place to carry out treatment. It says it's carrying out precise actions around the hospital and taking steps not to harm innocent civilians. It says similar things about what's been happening around hospitals in the south. The Al-Amal hospital is now basically closed off. It's been evacuated as Israeli troops move back into that area. And also in Khan Yunis, nearby at the Nasser hospital, we're now being told that Israeli tanks and armoured vehicles have moved back into that area. We're not hearing about a raid on that hospital yet, but it's really raised fears about the people said to number thousands who are inside. So you're overall left with the situation where you've got fewer and fewer hospitals that are able to function, even partially.
Yolande Nell. As we record this podcast, a New York judge is about to rule on what sentence the perpetrator of what's being called one of the biggest financial crimes in US history should get. Sam Bankman-Fried, who founded the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, was found guilty of fraud and money laundering last year. The former billionaire CEO potentially faces decades in prison for fraud and conspiracy charges stemming from his role in the massive collapse of FTX. His legal team have called for leniency, but prosecutors are seeking 40 to 50 years in prison. As we wait for that sentence, I've been speaking to our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy, who interviewed Sam Bankman-Fried just before his arrest in December 2022.
It was in this really bizarre period after the empire had collapsed, this $32 billion empire. He was top of the pile, one of big influencers in crypto. It all came crashing down in 8 days. And we all expected any minute now that he was going to be arrested, and he was sort of hiding out in his luxury apartment in the Bahamas, and he started accepting requests from reporters to go and interview him. So we went there, and we had this very bizarre 45-minute interview where there were no questions off the table, no time limit. He answered everything and took it all on the chin, in a sense. And it was a strange thing where he sort of, it was like self-flagellation for him. And of course, we were channeling the energy of the million or so customers who were out of pocket. And all along, he was saying, yes, I made really bad business mistakes, but none of it was deliberate and none of it was criminal. And he was saying, and he seemed to be convinced he wouldn't be arrested and he wouldn't be convicted. But now, of course, he's about to be sentenced.
Yes, yeah, so he was convicted of fraud, money laundering. What about those customers? Did they recoup their money?
Not yet. No, they're still out of pocket and they're still waiting. And there's a big campaign from them to try and get a bit more than they're being promised. They're being told at the moment that enough of the $8 billion that went missing has been recovered now that they can claim back about 90% of what they lost. However, that sounds good, doesn't it? However, of course, they're getting back the dollar value of what they had in the FTX exchange at the time. And the FTX exchange allowed you to use your dollars and your pounds to exchange that for Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of the other cryptocurrencies. And of course, now that cryptocurrency has gone through the roof. It's four times worth the value of what it was when it all collapsed. So they're very upset at the loss of, I think they're calling it the loss of potential earnings.
That's just absolutely devastating for them. And at the same time, though, this doesn't seem to have dampened enthusiasm for cryptocurrency. As you say, Bitcoin is at a record high.
Yeah, well, interestingly, when the collapse happened, and it's partly because of the kind of wider market that meant that it collapsed. But if you look at the value of Bitcoin, this green line that everyone studies in the crypto world, which is kind of the barometer for the health and interest in the industry, you can see a little drop where Sam Bankman-Fried, where FTX collapsed. And then it stayed in what they call a crypto winter, where no one was interested. People were pulling their money out. The value was low, about $16,000 for one Bitcoin. And then slowly last year, we started to see it tick up a little bit, and it got higher and higher. And then about 3 or 4 weeks ago, it just went through the roof. And we're seeing records broken almost daily now with new highs of the value of Bitcoin because of what's happening in the US with US financial giants like BlackRock, Fidelity, and Grayscale pouring money into Bitcoin because they're now allowed to because they got given permission by the US authorities. And there's a few other things happening in the world of crypto which is getting people very excited. But you're right, it is through the roof, and it seems stronger than ever despite coming through this horrendous scandal that we're now seeing the conclusion of.
Joe Tardy. Johnny Kitagawa was Japan's most famous pop manager until his death in 2019. This despite long-standing allegations that he sexually exploited some of the thousands of boys and young men who he came into contact with during the course of his 60-year career. Now, the man tasked with arranging compensation for the victims has told the BBC that he believes two other men at Kitagawa's company were also sexual predators. Mobeen Azar is following the story.
Johnny Kitagawa was a hitmaker. He held the world record for the most number one artist produced by an individual. Though after our BBC investigation, his child abuse was a scandal the country could no longer ignore. Its mainstream media reported the story for the first time, and the United Nations even investigated the company. Its CEO, Judy Fujishima, resigned.
I apologise to his victims from the bottom of my heart.
The company dissolved and a new one called Smile Up was set up to process the claims of abuse. I've come back to Japan for the first time in over a year to meet survivors and see how things have changed.
Akimasa.
Hello.
Just nice to meet you.
Akimasa is a former aspiring pop star and a survivor of Kitagawa's abuse.
Yeah, it was huge that the CEO admitted that the sexual assault happened. At the same time, I feel like there's still some issues that are hidden.
And he alleges that the abuse was even more widespread.
There was a report that says there were some staff members were sexually abusing the boy talent as well.
I took these allegations to Noriyuku Higashiyama, the CEO of the renamed company Smile Up, in what is his first ever interview since starting the job. We've spoken to a former junior who has said that they are aware of abuse at the hands of another member of staff, in addition to Johnny Kitagawa. Are you aware of those allegations?
I've heard there are two people.
Isn't that information that you should be handing over to the police?
From a legal standpoint, I don't think we have the authority to do that. But if those involved file a criminal complaint, I imagine we would cooperate as much as possible.
Morally, wouldn't it be the right thing to do?
To be honest, I don't know what the answer is. What is the right end result? What do the survivors want?
Smile Up has received criticism from victims for its handling of the compensation process. Days after being set up, it released a statement suggesting that some of the allegations were telling what they call false stories using the testimonies of real victims. The CEO has defended this statement, though he discourages online abuse. For some of the survivors, they believe this statement caused them to face online harassment. For one man, the abuse was so severe that it led him to take his own life. I spoke to his widow.
It was from that point that the online attacks increased. It's a fraud. It just wants money, they were saying. It's all your fault. As it received more online abuse, it looked depressed. Information about our child was posted. It's like the whole family was being attacked.
SmileUp told us their victim relief committee and counsellors both contacted him twice, but it's unclear when this happened.
Mobeen Azar reporting. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
He has terrible tusks and terrible claws and terrible teeth in his terrible...
The much-loved children's book, The Gruffalo, turns 25.
What stories and advice would you like to share with daughters everywhere?
And what are different countries around the world getting right in order for women to live well and succeed?
Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives
and what the rest of the world could learn from them.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new season. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News podcast. A murdering terrorist, a communist. It's not the kind of language you would expect one world leader to use about another. But that was how the Argentine president, Javier Milei, described his Colombian counterpart, Gustavo Petro, in a recent interview with the news channel CNN. Unsurprisingly, Colombia has reacted by expelling Argentine diplomats. BBC News Online's Latin America editor Vanessa Buschluter told us more about what Argentina's volatile president said in the interview, which is to be aired in full in the coming days.
Some clips have been released, and in this one clip, Milei suggested that Colombia, under its left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, could go down the road of Venezuela and Cuba. What he said, I quote, was, "In Venezuela, there's carnage. It's truly unprecedented. Same as that prison island, Cuba. And there are others who are going down that road, such as Colombia with Mr. Petro. Well, you can't expect much from someone who has been a murdering terrorist, right? He's a communist." So what he's referring to is the fact that Gustavo Petro was a member of the M19 rebel group in the 1980s. And that urban guerrilla group, a left-wing guerrilla group, did take part in the siege of the Justice Palace in Colombia, in which many people died. But it has to be stressed that Gustavo Petro, who's now a president, at the time was in prison. He did not take part in that siege.
And Colombia is saying he was democratically elected. What is the thinking behind these very extreme statements by the Argentine president?
Well, look, Javier Milei is famous slash infamous for attacking people and for using very, very colourful language. He is always swearing, and he's made a career out of attacking other leaders. And it also has to be seen in the context of Latin American politics, where personal attacks are the norm, sadly. And Mr. Milei, you know, hasn't just attacked other presidents in this particular interview. He also called the president of Mexico an ignorant man. But to the shock of everyone during the presidential campaign, which of course he then went on to win, Mr. Milei also attacked the Pope, his fellow Argentine citizen, and called him a communist and somebody who brought about evil on earth, which of course the Pope, I mean, you know,
extremely
equating
shocking.
Him with evil is just quite
yeah.
out there.
So this is a very serious diplomatic incident between Argentina and Colombia. Relations are already very difficult between them. What happens now?
We don't know how many Argentine diplomats are going to be expelled. Colombia hasn't given us a number. They haven't given us names. However, it also has to be said that in the past, Milei has made up with people he's insulted. So in the case of the Pope, for example, they hugged it out a few weeks ago and joked about it. And he's since said that he's revising his views on the Pope. So the same might happen with the Colombian president.
Vanessa Buschluter. It's been described as a game changer by scientists, a test that can detect signs of motor neurone disease before symptoms appear. Motor neurone disease is an incurable condition that affects the brain and nerves, causes muscle weakness that gets worse over time, and can cause premature death. The researchers say identifying the disease early could help to make treatments more effective. Dr. Jenna Gregory from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland was part of the study and told us more about the findings.
The most striking thing that I find about motor neurone disease is that everybody really has a completely different experience of the disease process. So people experience different combinations of symptoms and disease progression. And that actually makes it really difficult for us as clinicians to be able to diagnose the disease, particularly in those really early stages of the disease process. But, you know, despite this variable symptom burden, people are actually experiencing a very similar underlying disease process. So the presence of these protein clumps that get in the way of normal functioning of nerves in the brain and the spinal cord. So really what we desperately need for people affected by this disease are biomarkers to be able to detect this disease process, these protein clumps. And that's exactly what we've done in this work. So we've adapted small RNA molecules. They're typically used in cancer and Alzheimer's disease in diagnostics and therapeutics. And we've adapted the first one really so that we have one of these RNA aptamers for motor neurone disease. And we've shown in our work that we can detect the disease even before symptom onset, you know, using these biomarkers to detect disease in tissue or in blood or spinal fluid. Really, the thing that, you know, makes me get up in the morning to do our research is that we really need to be doing more for people affected by motor neurone disease. And, you know, in my mind, the earlier we intervene, the more likely we are to be successful with therapies. And, you know, that's exactly what we're doing with this tool, is to be able to detect the earlier stages of the disease before people develop substantial disability, substantial symptom burden, to give us the best chance of doing exactly that. But these biomarkers, they'll also give us the opportunity to see if therapies are working in people.
Dr. Jenna Gregory. Now to rural France, in a town that's just a stone's throw away from the Swiss border. It was a location of choice for the far-right National Rally's second stop on the campaign trail for the European parliamentary elections due to be held in June. The party is keen to build on its growing success in recent years, especially with young voters. Mark Urban has been to the industrial town of Montbéliard to speak to people there about why the far-right speaks to them.
Montbéliard in the Jura, one of those places on the mountainous fringes of France, a borderland close to Germany and Switzerland.
What you've got here is typical of what they call La France profonde, deep France, these rural areas where job losses, economic dislocation, unhappiness with the way things are have created opportunities. On the far left, it's true, but mainly for the far right. The question is whether in these elections they'll make really substantial gains and change the political game in France.
Christian Corrouge worked at the Peugeot car plant for decades. Now it's largely closed. He's trying to organise resistance to the far right.
With the rise of the National Front, I felt I had to talk about it because it seems so disgusting, so nauseating. It smells like sewage. It's like the plague coming. I do not want that, neither for me nor my grandchildren.
These days, the National Front calls itself the National Rally, and Quentin Maculot is among their local militants or activists under the leadership of Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella, the party's new talent who's coming to Montbéliard.
These two complement each other. Marine Le Pen is going to reach more people that are grassroots National Front supporters. Jordan Bardella will speak to the youth, the school children, the university students, those who are not usually interested in politics. His communication skills are relatability, make people more interested in the National Rally.
Many here feel they've lost their sense of security, both economic and from crime. Flavie Jacquot is a floating voter who wants to feel safe again.
I don't know who I'll vote for. I haven't decided yet. But what's important in a small town like this is security. I live in the centre of town. I want to walk my dog in the evening in peace. I don't want any aggression or to be whistled at.
At Montbéliard's concert hall, the crowds gather, thousands of people.
For decades, many French thought of this as a far-right party, a racist party. So what they've done is to rebrand it, changing the name 6 years ago, and now increasingly trying new messages and new faces, like Jordan Bardella. And here, at least, it's drawing the crowds.
Across town, a counter-demonstration. It's clear, though, that those objecting to Jordan Bardella's presence here are considerably outnumbered. Finally, the moment arrives. Thousands greet the National Rally's bright new hope. The party president, just 28 years old, and now spearheading campaigning for June's European elections.
France is not conformism to a single way of thinking. France is not the prior prohibition of expression. France is a country of freedom, and we at Rassemblement National intend to keep it that way forever.
The morning after the rally, and the regular Saturday food market springs up outside the venue. Of course, the far right can get votes, but as the recent Dutch elections or past European ones show, that doesn't mean anyone else is ready to do political business with them. So the right gets ready to harvest votes here and across this country. As to whether that can amount to more than a protest movement, that'll be up to Jordan Bardella and the others elected to the European Parliament.
Mark Urban. Well, with just a few months to go before those elections, the EU has been putting pressure on social media firms to do more to counter misinformation. 2024 is also a very busy election year around the world. The video sharing platform TikTok has launched an online election centre which it says will help young voters make informed decisions. TikTok has around 142 million monthly active users in the EU alone, and it's increasingly used by young people as a source of political information. Stephanie Prentice reports.
It's estimated more than 2 billion people in more than 50 countries will go to the polls this year. And with government agencies asking social media sites to do more to combat disinformation and clearly flag things like AI content, TikTok has its solution. The first iteration will be an election hub for UK voters. The online centre will be a place to get verified information, debunk fake news, watch educational videos and get the basics. How, where and when someone can vote. Users will get there through prompts on related posts or searches. The company said it was planning to introduce similar centres in other countries around the world, tailored to each election. Its main adversary is the rise in AI-generated content and the potentially damaging impact it could have. The European Union has been pressuring social media giants to commit to action ahead of Europe-wide polls, with threats of hefty fines for improper content moderation. Brussels especially fears the impact of Russian manipulation on elections taking place in the bloc's 27 member states in June and will conduct what it calls stress tests on content on 22 platforms in April.
Stephanie Prentice. Now, this month marks 25 years since the Gruffalo hit bookshelves. Julia Donaldson's story of a friendly beast, illustrated by Axel Scheffler, has sold millions of copies around the world. But on his silver jubilee, the author has some choice words for the monster she created. Gruffalo fan David Lewis picks up the story.
He has terrible tusks and terrible claws.
And terrible teeth in his terrible jaws. And now the Gruffalo is a quarter of a century old. Julia Donaldson's tale about the horned beast with somewhat lackluster dental standards who befriends a mouse in a wooded forest is loved by children and tired parents across the globe. The popular bedtime book's been translated into more than 100 languages and dialects and made a mint for the author. Together with its sequel, The Gruffalo's Child, it's sold more than 18 million copies. But the monster's creator isn't all about celebrating. Donaldson insists that he hogs too much attention. Speaking with BBC Scotland, the 75-year-old author said, "What I like is when people single out one of my other books as their favourite, as I think the Gruffalo's a bit spoilt." And she may have a point. Donaldson has written 210 books, many with longtime collaborator, illustrator Axel Scheffler. Some, like Tabby McTatt and Stickman, have also been made into live-action features. She went on to say there was a possibility the Gruffalo would never see the light of day. It sat on one publisher's desk for about a year, she insisted. Originally, the Gruffalo was going to be about a tiger, but Donaldson couldn't find a word to rhyme with it. The Gruffalo was created as its name rhymes with "Oh help, oh no."
He's the Gruffalo.
David Lewis reporting. And that's all from us for now. But there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The producer was Chantal Hartle. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.